Okay, welcome back to Firewall. As usual, I'm your host, Bradley Tusk. With me today is a really exciting guest, Dr. Ezekiel Emanuel. Dr. Emanuel, thanks so much for joining us.
Good to be here.
So I'm actually going to, I could ask you to give your bio. Obviously, the listeners kind of know who you are, but it is so impressive that I think you would be modest and short, give it the short shrift. So I think I'm going to do it for you, if that's okay. So you're the Vice Provost of Global Initiatives at Penn, Special Advisor to the Director General of the World Health Organization, Senior Fellow at the Center for American Progress, the Founding Chair of the Department of Bioethics at the National Institute for Health, Special Advisor in Health Policy to the Director of Office of Management Budget and the National Economic Council. You're a breast oncologist, an author, a member of the Council on Foreign Relations, Chair of the Medical Council on Future of Healthcare Committee for the World Economic Forum. You have been elected to the Institute of Medicine of the National Academy of Science, the Association of American Physicians, and the Royal College of Medicine. You won Doctor of the Year in Ethics from Hippocrates Magazine, and lots of other awards here. So obviously, congratulations on your success, and I'm sure you have a pretty strong case to make when you go home for Thanksgiving and the three of you argue over who's most successful.
I lose that every year.
I think you're coming up, though. I think, you know, Rahm's out of office, and Devers kind of had a little bit of a rough stretch, so I think you might be coming around here. But anyway, thank you so much for joining us. It's really an honor to have you on. And, you know, you just wrote a book that came out, I think, a week and a half ago, Which Country Has the Best Healthcare? And it's really fascinating book. And if nothing else, if you listen to this podcast, go out and buy a copy of it. You'll be really happy you did. So just to kind of start talking about it, what made you choose to tackle that specifically?
Audiences, people like your listeners. I would go around the country talking about healthcare, and invariably, one of the first few questions was, well, which country has the world's best healthcare system? And I would, you know, try to parry that question and say, I really don't want to answer that question. And here's why. You know, we can't just go to pick your favorite country, take what they do, and shift it here. It just doesn't work that way. There are too many interest groups here. There's too many institutional structures, et cetera. And then I also knew that there were a lot of rankings already out there. There are 9 of them, as far as we could tell. The granddaddy of them all is the World Healthcare Organization ranking from 2000 that had France and Italy at the top. And when you look at them, they come up with all different rankings. So France is number 1 in the World Healthcare Organization. It doesn't come out in the, I think this is right, it doesn't come out in the top 10 in any other ranking. And then some of the rankings just make no sense at all. You know, you've got countries that you can't believe, and they turn out to be more efficient than Germany and the Scandinavian countries and Switzerland. And you're like, you know, scratching your head, really? So I was sort of very resistant. But eventually I was like, well, maybe we can learn, if not the whole healthcare system, parts of their healthcare system that might be able to improve what we do. And the thing that was beginning to drive me was mostly around drug pricing and how other countries regulated drug prices. So I thought, you know, we don't do that. We're going to have to do that. Maybe we can learn something from how other countries have been successful at that.
And so how did you even determine what criteria you would use to decide who has the best healthcare? And if you're a consumer, how should you be looking at this? Is your concern which country is the best system, or what's the most accessible, affordable healthcare for you? You know, where, how do those two things align or not align?
Again, that's a really good question. So first of all, you know, I think some of the metrics are pretty clear. They're certainly clear from a policy wonk perspective, which is, look, you want a healthcare system that gets everyone covered. In the 21st century, to not have people covered seems like not just a mistake, but as COVID is making clear, it endangers all of us, and it, you know, I'm an ethicist too, so it's unethical. Second, you want a system that is affordable. It's not so expensive that it's robbing the country. Third, if you get coverage, you want to have a set of benefits that are pretty comprehensive. So that's what policy wonks like me look at. But then if you, as you point out, if you're a patient, there are certain things you really want. You want, you know, wide choice of doctors and hospitals. You want not to have high copays at the point when you get care, when you visit the primary care doctor, or when you go into the hospital. You want affordable drug prices. You don't want a long waiting list if you need an operation. So we came up with 22 different metrics. Some of them I think are obvious, like universality and relatively low cost. Many of them are criteria that, you know, primary that every patient would want covered. And then some of them we think are going to be of growing importance, like, you know, how well does the system address mental health care? How well does the system address long-term care given the growing number of elderly? Sure. So,
yeah. And so where, you know, where is the U.S.? I'm sure every listener, at least who's in the U.S. saying, okay, so where do we land? I think everyone's probably skeptical that we would be anywhere near the top. And what would it take for the U.S. to legitimately contend for having, you know, the best healthcare?
Well, we don't rank in the top 10. I'm pretty confident about that. On the other hand, I'm also pretty confident we're not the worst, at least in our review, which involves a total of 11 countries. China, I think, has a worse healthcare system than we do. And there are some places, probably be surprising to your audience, where I think we actually do excel. We put those under the rubric of innovation. We are a very innovative system, mainly because we have a lot of problems. And I'm not here talking about innovation in terms of new drugs, new devices, new surgical procedures, more imaging. I'm talking about innovation in how we deliver care, innovation in how we pay doctors and hospitals. There, we really are leading the world in new processes. So I think that's how we sort of assess the United States.
And so, you know, obviously the Sanders campaign came up a little short, but he clearly made some progress in advancing, you know, the concept of Medicare for all. Where do you think, based on all the kind of interactions you do with people everywhere across the country, where do you think the country is on it? And do you think we land at that at any time in the near future?
No, I don't. I think there are political reasons why that's true. I actually think that there are also policy reasons why it's probably not the best system. Remember, Bernie Sanders didn't want Medicare in all of what it does for all. He wanted a particular kind of Medicare, which is the fee-for-service system. That fee-for-service Medicare system was developed in the 1950s and 1960s, and it's really not optimal for healthcare today. We know that people who have chronic illness who are in the Medicare fee-for-service system, they end up seeing 14, 15 doctors. Often their care is uncoordinated. It's not the best way to get care. You really, for, you know, 85 cents of every dollar spent on healthcare goes for patients with chronic illness. And for those patients, you really do need to have well-managed care, someone actually taking responsibility. And that doesn't optimally happen under fee-for-service. It doesn't always happen in other parts of healthcare, but it is much more likely to happen in other parts of healthcare, like Medicare Advantage.
So let's assume, and maybe I'm jinxing it, but that both Biden wins and the Senate flips back over to the Democrats. So there's at least an opportunity to try to move some new policy through. What do you think is realistic to happen in the next couple of years that could improve the system?
Well, you know, I don't know whether you said this or not, but I actually have a PhD in political science.
And nope, I stopped reading the list after a while. I didn't even get to that.
So if you look at the political scientists, they say that you get major reform when three things happen simultaneously. It's not a guarantee, but here's how reform happens. Everyone recognizes you have a problem. Well, I think everyone recognizes our healthcare system is underperforming. Two, you have an agreed upon set of solutions. And three, there's some catalytic event that actually puts this at the top. That can be an election and flipping the Senate. That can be COVID-19. It could be a recession. All of those things can be this catalytic event. Well, you know, are we at that point? I think we pretty are at that point. And I do think if the Senate flips, Biden gets elected and does push the limit, I think that there is pretty big healthcare reform, in part because I think a wide swath of the public really wants it now. They recognize we still have 10% uninsured. By the way, 50 million people have lost their employer-sponsored insurance either because they're workers or their dependents. And that is going to propel them to say, listen, I want security. I want to make sure I have health coverage. And they're going to be pushing the government. Drug prices are high and people are upset by that. So I think you are going to have a confluence of events that's going to make healthcare reform possible.
Yeah. I mean, it's funny in that some of the concepts, like, for example, universal basic income, ended up almost inadvertently happening in some ways, you know, because of COVID-19 and the federal government's response to it. Yeah, it does seem like the value proposition for why some type of change is needed probably was highlighted and almost better formed by people experiencing a pandemic firsthand than kind of hearing politicians yell at each other, you know, in debates and things like that. Obviously, as we're talking right now, there's been a real either resurgence or surge of COVID in certain parts of the U.S., especially the South. Why do you think that happened? And if you were the governor of Texas or Florida or whatever, what would you be doing to limit it?
Yeah, well, I don't think it's any mystery why it happened. These states opened up their economy. They were not ready to open up. They hadn't even gotten the number of cases coming down for 14 straight days. They violated even the president's open the economy plan. They didn't have cases coming down for 14 days, hospitalizations coming down for 14 days. And they opened up all at once instead of a phased approach. And they opened up some of the places where you know spread is most likely to happen, like bars, like salons, like indoor restaurants. These are, you know, prescriptions for a big surge in cases. And so is this a mystery? Should a governor say, wow, how did this happen? I didn't expect this. No, you expected this. You should have known this was going to happen. Every epidemiologist in the country was saying this is going to happen. And so I don't think it's a mystery. You want to actually get control of this. And it's pretty clear. You've got to impose the public health measures. You've got to impose them stringently. But if you do them stringently, you know, with rigor, you can actually do it for a short time, 4 or 6 weeks, and then the number of cases will be very low and you can open up safely if you have put in place an infrastructure of testing, contact tracing, and isolation. We've seen these numbers from not just China, Europe now, Italy, and other countries, and it works. We decided not to be stringent. And, you know, places like Arizona said, well, we're not seeing any cases. We don't have to do these public health measures. You saw that in Florida. Well, okay, we'll see. You know, those of us in the public health community said, you know, you'll see. And you can see 4 weeks after Memorial Day. Yeah, there's this big spike. And it's not a mystery why it happened.
So let's award the governors of, say, Arizona or Texas or Florida kind of the best of intentions, right? You're an ethicist. And they would say, well, look, you know, as you said yourself, 50 million people have lost their employer-sponsored health care. 40 million people have lost their jobs. The human cost of a shutdown and a quarantine are equally significant, if not greater, than the health risk of the pandemic itself. I was trying to achieve the greatest good. How do you respond to that?
Well, you can open up safely the economy only when you get your arms around this public health issue. You are not going to safely open up the economy and really get people to spend money and resume their economic activity unless you control the public health situation. So I'm totally sympathetic. I wrote an article in April about how to open up the economy, yep, and what we need to do for it. And, you know, the fact is, the sequence is clear. Get the COVID-19 under control, get it to a very low level of new cases, open up the economy in phases, and if new cases arise, isolate them, contact trace them, and you can actually open up the economy safely. They didn't do that. They were rushing to, first of all, they never really did institute the public health measures. They're still resistant to instituting face masks, and they're opening up the most dangerous parts of the economy in the first or second wave. That is not a wise prescription. And again, this isn't a mystery.
No, not in the slightest. So it's hard to argue. At least the lesson going forward from what you're saying then is, even if you want to weigh the cost differently and say that you are more concerned about those impacted by a shutdown than necessarily those put at risk of a disease or a virus, it still requires taking the underlying steps no matter what, right? And if you don't do that, it doesn't really matter how much you're sort of sympathizing or empathizing with the unemployed or business owner.
Well, here's the question. Yeah. You think airplanes are going to become full, restaurants are going to become full, hotels are going to become full if people think they can get COVID-19 and potentially die by doing that. Yes, some people will, but you're not going to get them back to the economic activity we had in November and December 2019. And that is the fallacy that these governors who rushed in bought. And I think it's a mistake.
Does anything get us back to that level until there is a vaccine that's proven effective and fully distributed?
Yes. I'm sorry to say, yes.
So what do you think that would take? And what where do you think we really are, since there are so many different companies working on different products?
Yeah, there are over 125 different efforts on the vaccine. I don't think we're going to, get one before 2021. We're going to start these effectiveness trials beginning in the next, month or so. But enrolling 30,000 people, giving them 20,000 of the vaccine, following them so that they get exposed to COVID and we see how many people get infected or not, that takes time. And so I don't think we're going to have a real result before 2021. And then you have to distribute and immunize people, even if we're producing a vaccine at risk, that is, before we have the final result as to whether it's protective, it still takes time to get a shot in 200 million people's arms. So I think most of us were unlikely to see or be vaccinated before, call it Q3 2021. So I think that...
Yeah, so that's realistically where we are.
Yeah, and people have to plan their lives that way. And I can tell you, I'm in general an optimist. So I'm in general, and I'm also in general a risk taker. And when I say these things, people are like, I can't, they're not planning that far. A lot of people are like, well, in September it'll be different, or in January 2021 it'll be different. And I was like, you got to think of Q3 2021. And I'm sorry, it is going to be, tough going between now and then. And we have to have a leader who is straightforward and honest with the public. This isn't going to change overnight. I'm sorry about that. Winston Churchill said, you got blood, toil, and tears. Okay, but here's how we're going to get through it. Here's what we're going to do all together. But we don't have that leader.
No, we very much do not. So kind of speaking of what at least government needs to do, you and your brother Ram have put together, I think, a really interesting proposal that almost kind of trades certain responsibilities between state government and federal government to try to both address the public health crisis and some of the other larger issues in society. How would it work?
So the idea is, let's go to healthcare. We can't get to universal coverage in the current system. The Supreme Court said that states could opt out of expanding Medicaid. And as a consequence, while 36 states have expanded Medicaid, 14 states seem to be totally resistant to expanding Medicaid, even though it's financially advantageous to them. So Texas and Georgia and Florida and North Carolina and a bunch of others, representing a third of the American population, will not expand Medicaid. That means we have no path to universal coverage. We cannot get to full 100% coverage because these states won't expand Medicaid. So if we want to get to universal coverage, we have to nationalize Medicaid. That's what my brother and I argued. So you have to take Medicaid from the states and make it a federal program like Medicare. That'll also make it a lot more efficiently run because you won't have 50 programs. You'll have one uniform program. Second, unemployment is also similarly problematic. The benefits vary from state to state. They're as short as 12 weeks. The amount that is given to people also varies. We need to nationalize unemployment. And by the way, we're already nationalizing unemployment through the CARES Act in our response to COVID, as you point out. So why not do it for real? This is also a way of relieving states of these financial obligations. The quid pro quo is that states, you have to use the money you're saving for investments that'll provide long-term benefits, investments in education, you know, early childhood interventions that we know pay returns of $7 to $15 for every dollar invested, free universal pre-K to children 3 and 4 years old, free community college. And then there's huge investments on the infrastructure that need to be made, better roads, better bridges, better water systems, improving schools. This is going to be a deal that most states and Democrats would love to take. And states, whether they're Republican or Democratic, would love it. They want to get rid of the financial albatross of Medicare and Medicaid and unemployment.
Absolutely.
So?
Yeah. So two questions. I think you're absolutely right. I used to work in government. I was the deputy governor of your home state of Illinois. And never really, if you had said to me, hey, would you like to get rid of Medicaid and unemployment? Yeah, I would have signed up in a heartbeat, right? It was never kind of what you look forward to every morning and trying to run and deal with.
Exactly. And you know, my brother is the politician. And so he used to said, you know, just ask a politician, which do they want? They want to go to a graduation of kindergarten or high school? Or do they want to say, well, we're expanding the Medicaid rolls this year? Of course they want to go to, you know, graduation. Which would they prefer? To be there, you know, shoveling, opening up a new building, you know, laying the cornerstone for a new building? Or saying, you know, we expanded our Medicaid coverage, our unemployment coverage policy. Of course they want to be there shoveling and showing people that they're improving the economy and the infrastructure. So you have to give politicians what they want, and you have to make the programs work for the population. So that was the heart of our proposal.
And what's the revenue source? Because I assume that it's obviously additive cost based on everything you outlined.
Yes, it's going to be additive cost at the federal level, and the federal government is going to have to absorb it. You know, we can discuss what we think the added cost is. You know, my own view is, you know, those companies that aren't providing health insurance to their workers or have made their workers contract workers so they can take away their fringe benefits, they have to pay a payroll tax. And I think that's the only fair way. So Uber can't say, well, these are contractors. We have these, you know, tens of thousands of drivers, but we don't have to pay. No, you have to pay a payroll tax for them.
I mean, what's interesting is, you know, and this is more technical on some of the venture stuff than you're interested in, but the, you know, there's been a big debate around classification of workers in the sharing economy. And it's been seen as this kind of binary choice of either their employees with all the full regalia and benefits and obligations of being an employee, or they're independent contractors with none of it. And it gets framed as, you know, tech doesn't want to provide any benefits and unions want to make sure that there are benefits. And in reality, you know, if you ask most startups in the sharing economy, they would say, look, I'd like to be able to contribute to a portable benefits plan where people still have, you know, the legal freedom to operate as an independent contractor, but I'm paying for their health care, or they can put that money into, you know, disability or pensions or whatever else they want. And every platform they work on pays into it. But by doing so, that then isn't used against me as evidence by State Department of Labor to say that I am a full-time employer. It seems like at the very least, you could adopt a portable benefits plan and get a lot of that done. And states could do that. The problem is, I think both sides are so dug in on their spot and their position, it's hard to move forward.
I agree with you. I think we need to just get employers half in the gig economy have to provide a contribution, payroll tax for benefits that is for the people who work for them, regardless of how they are classified. Contractors, full-time employees, part-time employees. You know, people shouldn't be part-time employees for three different employers to get a full-time pay and then get no benefits because they're part-time employers. I think we have to have a uniform payroll assessment to provide benefits for everyone. And, you know, that's an essence, an essential part, of a decent society.
Yeah. Agreed. One topic that's related, but a little different, but I think of interest to a lot of our listeners, is telemedicine. I think a lot of people who listen to this podcast either work in startups in the telemedicine space or are funds like ours that have invested in telemedicine. What's your sense of the sector? And, you know, what would you, if you were advising the telemedicine world as to how to take the most advantage of COVID to kind of accelerate their growth, what would you tell them to do?
Well, we have had a decade's worth of progress in about 4 months because of the closing of offices, the limited admissions to hospitals. So I think that's been huge. And I think there's no physician practice that is going backwards. They have to figure out how to use it. They have to get paid for it. My own view is we should not pay fee for service for each thing. Doctors should figure out what's most efficient and effective for managing their patients. And we should, you know, I've been a big advocate of what is called alternative payment models, where you pay primary care doctors and many specialists capitation, and they figure out, you know, what's the right combination of telemedicine, in-person interviews, home visits, et cetera, for the patients. You know, I assume for many people who are the worried well, as we say, or people with minor conditions, a telemedicine visit is going to be perfectly fine. For people with complicated chronic illnesses, you're going to need probably in-person visits still. So I think you have to get it right. And I don't think, you know, paying fee for services is a way to get it right. The way to get it right is to pay doctors and have them use their expertise to figure out which visits are right. I would advise the telemedicine world, you know, make the platforms that doctors are going to use. Make it simple, integrate it into the EHR so that they can take notes.
No, that makes total sense. And one encouraging thing, you know, because we only invest in issues that are kind of somewhat regulated. For whatever reason, most tech issues somehow end up being adopted by either one side, one party or the other, as, you know, they support this. And telemedicine is one of the few things that we see across the board people embrace, conservatives, liberals, just because I think it's hard for anyone to sort of not see the benefit in it. So I think the opportunity that you lay out there is really present because it will not require massive policy or structural reform that's kind of ideologically divisive in the way that most things run healthcare.
I also think it's a good way to solve the problem related to rural medicine. It's hard. It's forever going to be hard to get doctors to move to, you know, rural states like North Dakota, South Dakota, especially specialists. And so you have to use some version of telemedicine. Now that every doctor's experienced in using telemedicine, that, you know, getting them in and getting them the right care is going to be more doable as long as it can happen across state lines. And again, that's another reason to think of nationalizing many of these.
Yeah, you wouldn't have all the license. Yeah, I mean, one little thing to deal with sometimes is interstate licensing, and you wouldn't have to worry about that if Medicaid were nationalized. Yeah, I mean, telemedicine also to us seems like a really good opportunity where there are rural areas that don't have a lot of providers. But I think as anyone who has sort of continued their therapy over Zoom or phone or FaceTime, had them doing in person, it transfers over reasonably well. And so to the more that we believe that providing mental health care is important as a society, you know, telemedicine really gives the opportunity to do that, I think. Final question, which is, all right, so fast forward 5 or 10 years from now, you know, you've looked at this system here from a healthcare standpoint, probably the most comprehensive way of anyone. You called yourself an optimist before. Do we have a better system in 10 years or where we are or even worse?
I think we have a better system. And I wrote that in the book. And I think the main reason we have a better system is, first, we have a lot of innovation happening. And I think we are going to solve some of these and scale. You know, it's not just solve. Part of our problem is we have solved many of these problems, but we haven't scaled them. Chronic care management, mental health care. So I do think we can solve those problems. I do wish that there was more push on payment reform because I think that's essential to getting docs really interested in adopting some of these delivery system reforms. So I think that's the direction we have to go.
Okay. Sounds great.
And I do think we'll get better. Okay.
All right. Dr. Emanuel, thank you so much for joining us. It was really an honor to have you on.
Fantastic. And now you need me to just hold tight while you upload.
Correct. You've done this once or twice, it sounds like.